James Jones has entered the game, and that means it is time to start the Twitter NBA show.
Welcome, replay viewers. We're going to start, and we're going to actually have a fun show. We're going to talk about the two different games today. First, Cleveland-Portland, then Memphis-Oklahoma City. Also, we're going to do All-Star starters, and we're going to, if we have time, we're going to talk about DeMarcus Cousins, along with questions that are via Twitter, the hashtag Twitter NBA show, and via Periscope.
All right, let's get moving here, talking about this Cleveland-Portland game first. Really more of the same in the second half as through the competitive portion of the game ended about halfway through this fourth quarter. Portland was only up by 10, and then at the start of the fourth, they really went at Kyrie Irving with CJ McCollum, who was outstanding in the second half. They were not able to get him off in the first half as he was guarded by Kyrie. Kyrie had to guard either Dame or him, and then Cleveland finally got taken advantage of there.
Both teams struggled a lot throughout this game shooting the three-pointer, and one of the things that changed was Portland started hitting a few late. I mean, still Aminu struggled, but they were able to get enough there to push the lead to 20 and really take it out of hand. And that's what you want to do when you're home and you're against a good team that is fatigued. I mean, both teams are fatigued, but you still want to push that throttle when you can.
Yeah, when I was talking about them going after Kyrie, this is the sort of thing that, and Stotts really deserves a lot of credit for this. After a timeout when it looked like Cleveland was going to get it under 10, he ran a nice action with Plumlee in the post. They had Alan Crabb fake like he was going to come out to the top, fake like he was going to set a screen where a switch would be required. He cuts right to the basket, was being guarded by Kyrie, gets a layup to stanch the bleeding. CJ, they ran their flare screen stuff for him against Kyrie. They ran a down screen where he hit a mid-range jumper. They ran another down screen where he curled in the lane and he got a bucket. He hit a couple of threes at the start of the fourth quarter over Kyrie as well. And especially on the off-ball stuff, that's where Kyrie really can struggle. And the other thing that I thought was a little bit of a weakness here, we've seen the Cavs struggle now offensively in back-to-back games. They also barely beat Phoenix as well on this Western trip. And I think they're starting to feel now the loss of J.R. Smith.
They are, and also feeling their lack of depth on the wing overall. That was a part of the motivation, of course, for making the Kyle Korver trade. And something that really struck me about this game, which was also true of the Utah game, is Cleveland not moving the ball. I talked about it a little bit at halftime. As of when we're starting this, Cleveland only has 11 assists on 24 made baskets. By comparison, the Blazers have 28 assists on 38 made baskets, closer to what you want for a ball movement team. And Cleveland, of course, can move the ball incredibly well, but they've been more stagnant. And I think some of that is J.R. Smith being missing.
Yeah, the NBA average usually is about 60% or so of your buckets are going to be assisted, maybe a little bit under that at times. The Warriors lead the league with like 70%. I think the next highest team is like 63. So it might actually be a little bit under 60% this year. It usually hovers in that area. But Cleveland, not a team that really plays the beautiful game in the sense that they're moving the ball all the time, running a bunch of intricate actions. I mean, they have some of their nice pet sets that they go to, like that elbow DHO series that they'll run with the bench a lot. But for Cleveland, it's all about their individual playmakers drawing two to the ball and then moving the ball around and having great shooters. Now, when you have DeAndre Liggins out there with the starters, they weren't guarding him at all. He missed a couple of corner threes, and how many actions of theirs were mucked up pick and roll type of plays? They did a nice job, Portland did, of putting two on the ball in the pick and roll, then bringing the weak side corner in to help on the roll man, and then the only pass was to Liggins and he wasn't able to make him pay.
And there are a couple different ways that a player in that situation can try to make an opponent pay. Ideally, they can hit the open shot that is created, but if they can't do that, maybe you drive and try to force some help. But Liggins at this point in his career isn't particularly adept at any of those ways, and so that is why he's not a starter on most teams at this point. He can still be a very useful rotation player. They need to
good defense on Dame
absolutely
Lillard in this game.
Yeah, Lillard had struggled in that first half, didn't have the best game overall, and Liggins deserves a lot of credit for that. He made life hard, got in his airspace. Lillard ended, when we're doing this, 5 of 15 from the field, 14 total points, so that's better than most guys do against him.
Yeah, but surprising that Kyrie would not be able to get off, and I think a big part of that was the way that they defended the pick and roll, getting the ball out of his hands. That seemed like it was pretty effective. So
something teams do to Portland all the time.
Yeah, that's true, and I think Terry Stotts very pleased with the game that he coached. I think both defensively they had a great plan, and then the ways that they went after Kyrie, and of course he's still well known for running some of the best stuff. So nice job there by him. And for Cleveland now, it'll be a two-game losing streak. They play Sacramento over the weekend, and then that massive showdown against Golden State on Martin Luther King Day.
It's an exciting kind of stretch also for Portland. We've talked at the halftime show about how they've looked good defensively, at least comparatively, with Al-Farouq Aminu back in the lineup. That stayed true tonight. They were forcing competitive shots. And while we don't have enough of a sample yet to say that's real or that the Portland defense is going to be there, really, if their offense is humming, if they can be somewhere around 20th, I think that's enough. And they're showing enough that that seems reasonable to me.
Yeah, for Portland, CJ, 27 points on 20 shots. And then Mo Harkless, outstanding defending LeBron. LeBron, another game where you could say he was a little bit disengaged, I think, on both ends. Tried to get into the post and overpower guys. Didn't seem to have the juice to do that on a lot of occasions. And then Mo Harkless did a really nice job on him. Turner even had a couple of times where he stripped him. And I thought that the last possession of the third quarter was pretty telling. LeBron had hit a couple of threes, and there was a play with a double high set at the elbows where he actually could have used the screen. That both the guys, Korver and I forget who the other shooter was, I think maybe Fry, set screens for him. He didn't even try to use the screens, and it wasn't a situation where they were trying to run the clock down because there was a big differential there anyway, shot clock to game clock. And he just took a step back, like 29 footer, like without even trying to make any kind of a move. It was just not a good shot, and kind of indicative a little bit of maybe where the Cavs are at this point, kind of in the doldrums of their season.
LeBron can be challenging for me to read sometimes. I mean, usually you can tell by context whether he's shooting those threes because he's just settling or whether he's just really feeling his jump shot. In this game, at that point, it was a little bit of both, but he did look flat at moments overall. Just, you know, it was one of those days that happens when you're 32 years old.
Yeah, so hit us up with some Periscope questions. We're always ready for those on these games. We're going to have some more of that hashtag Twitter NBA show as well. A couple more points on this one. I thought for Portland, you know, we talked about how well Harkless played. I think that part of the reason they made that mistake with Turner, that four-year $70 million deal, was maybe undervaluing Harkless. If they had believed that he was the solution that I think you and I both, me more so than you, maybe thought that he was, and I think he's turning into that. If they believed that he was the solution, maybe you don't put resources in on the wing.
And also with CJ McCollum, like McCollum's ability to run the offense during the time that Lillard has been out, not only when he was out due to injury, but just during the minutes that Lillard sits, has been better, I think, than they anticipated. And so that reduced the need as well. Harkless has been very good this season. And another great example of a player who can be very useful when he's your fourth or fifth best offensive player, because when he on the court at a given time, he can make good decisions out there. He tries hard on defense, and they need a player on the perimeter who does those things. He is that player.
Yeah, so for the Cavs, Portland remains a house of horrors. There's the first year that they, LeBron's return, David Blatt had comments about how he wasn't using him well. He only had 12 points. Last year was the game after the Christmas game. They got completely blown out. Blatt was almost fired at that point and then was fired shortly after that next Warriors loss on Martin Luther King Day. And then, of course, tonight as well, LeBron, Kevin Love, who returned from a tweaked ankle or knee, it wasn't clear exactly what, in the second quarter, and then Kyrie combined for 14 out of 43 shooting in this one.
Let's take a quick break to talk to you about CISO, SEESO. You can go there right now, CISO.com, using the promo code CAPSPACE and get 2 months free. Why do you want to do that? CISO is an awesome comedy site. It's ad-free and just $3.99 a month after your initial 2 free months using that CAPSPACE code, which of course you can recall by the fact that we talk about CAPSPACE all the time on this program. CISO has every episode of SNL ever. New episodes the day after they air if you're a cord cutter and you missed it. British comedies like The Original Office with Ricky Gervais, the entire Monty Python catalog, which is fantastic. And you can also discover the next big names in comedy with great specials. Watch all the icons before they made it big. Louis C.K., Hannibal Buress, Chelsea Peretti. The list goes on. Amy Schumer, Bo Burnham. See, the list actually goes on when I said the list goes on this time. I didn't just run out of people to say. So again, this is awesome for cord cutters. If you want the best new original comedy, under $4 a month, and you can try it out for free with that promo code CAPSPACE as well. CISO.com, SEESO.com, promo code CAPSPACE is how you get started with them.
Anything else in this? You want to move on to the more interesting, at least to me, game between Oklahoma City and Memphis?
Yeah, I'm going to close this document right now. Let's get to Memphis and OKC.
So my biggest takeaway from this, and it's weird to say in a game that Oklahoma City won by 8 points against a very good opponent, was what happened in the second half once Memphis made the fateful switch of putting Tony Allen on Russell Westbrook a whole lot more. Before the final minute when Westbrook was getting fouled because Oklahoma City had that lead, he was 1 for 8 from the field, 3 for 4 from the line, so that's 5 points total. They were even, and if you're ahead in a game, if you're even for that stretch, it's okay. But it was impressive to see Tony Allen do that.
Yeah, I thought so. And we had talked about, is it better to have Allen on Westbrook? Is it better to have him on Victor Oladipo? I think that question was answered, at least in the short term. And so much of what Westbrook was doing was really overpowering guys with his back to the basket. The other thing I like about that, too, is it saves Mike Conley a little bit for offense. You're not like just having to put all of your effort into keeping yourself from getting steamrolled, basically.
And I don't think Oladipo is going to really take advantage of that size mismatch enough. Like, even just from a shooting perspective, I mean, he'll notice that Conley's there. And when Oladipo will shoot when he's open, and it's not like he's bad in any way at that. But there's not a difference, like, let's say you were putting Kate Felder on him or something, where he just treat him as a ball rack.
Yeah, and Oladipo, I thought, still wasn't really able to do that much until a key stretch down the end. This game was a lot closer than you would have thought, and as I go through my notes here, I'm remembering that now. It was 88-86. Cantor had what was a controversial tip-in. I don't think we ever really got a great replay of that, but it looked live like it was very close. All the Memphis players were doing this thing. But, like, it always kills me when you do that because, like, especially on tip dunks, it's like, that's the first thing someone thinks of is, like, when you just gave up a tip dunk to the other team or you let the guy get right to the rim, and it's like, well, how about this? Like, maybe, like, box out instead.
Especially when they can't review it. You know, like, it's very different if you're trying to encourage a review on something that maybe a ref missed. I totally get that, you know.
Yeah, well, it was close. I mean, they may not have realized because that took place, I think, with like 2:26 remaining. And so under 2 minutes, you might have even seen the refs call the goaltend because that triggers the review. If you don't call it, then there's no review. So they probably, if it's close, they will just call it at that point. But it was not under 2 minutes, so that wasn't available to them. So there was that tip-in, and it was 90-86 at that point. I noted, too, that like both of the teams were closing big. We talked about, are they going to go at the four? Billy Donovan, who's he going to go with? He went with Cantor. Then Memphis went with Zach Randolph. I don't know if I would have done that necessarily if I were Memphis. And Zach's been playing very well, so I understand why they would go there. But I think that Cantor is just so much better of a player offensively than any of OKC's other options at the four, that kind of letting him survive defensively with Randolph and instead of making him guard in space, it kind of, even though Randolph might be a better player than Jamichael Green versus whoever OKC would throw out in a small lineup, I like that advantage more for Memphis than Randolph over Cantor.
It would have created seams for everybody offensively, and defensively you can handle that with a double with some pressure. Cantor is he's been better as a passer this year than I have noticed it before, and he deserves credit for that, but I don't think he's going to kill you. And you have so much of a duplication of skill sets offensively between him and Adams, and it exacerbates the floor spacing issues that Oklahoma City has all the time anyway.
Yeah, so Memphis, the clutch gods, had their chances in this game. Victor Oladipo committed an over the backbreaker on Vince Carter, which over the backbreaker is basically, you know, an offensive foul going for a rebound when you're in the bonus. So you're basically walking to the other end to shoot free throws, going for a rebound you had no chance at. Vince Carter bricks both free throws, not particularly close on either of those. And then the next time down, Tony Allen, great defense on Russ, denies him for half the possession. They finally get it to him. Marc Gasol steps up beautifully. And at that point, they force a steal with off of Westbrook. Gasol throws it ahead to Conley. Steven Adams, who had set that screen, sprints down in a play somewhat reminiscent of that great play he made in game 2 against the Spurs last year. And he foiled the whole possession all the way through.
Conley just got a little bit scared. I still think we didn't get a great second look at it from an alternate angle. I think he could have gotten the shot off or at least gotten a foul. He pulls it back out and they go through some other things, but it ends up that Adams is still on Mike Conley. Conley tries to shoot over him. He does not successfully shoot over him.
And they tried to post up Gasol on Westbrook, too. Westbrook, we talked about how one of the things he is good at is switching. He did a great job fronting Gasol in the post, not letting him get the ball down there. And then Conley had to take that three over Adams, not a shot he wanted to take. And they got the block, and then Oladipo hit a corner three off the fast break on the way down. And it was a 7-point game with 1:30 left, and it was over.
Yeah, and that led you to looking into something really interesting with Mike Conley since he got back from this back fracture.
Yeah, he's only taken 23 shots at the rim since he returned, and that's in 11 games, so basically two a game. We're talking talking about here. And I think that rate is down a little bit, but it's something we talked about on Dunked On recently is that he really has traded a lot of his shots at the rim. Never a guy who is finishing at the rim at a great rate, you know, since his very early days. He's traded them for three-pointers, but he really looks very reluctant, whether it's because he feels he has a lack of explosion. I mean, he's much more into kind of the floater game at this point. Like, he's not really going to go into guys, draw contact either. And maybe he just, you know, he doesn't want to get knocked down. That back fracture is still something that's bothering him. But that'll be something to look at here, because they just do not have a lot of ability to get to the rim. And that's why another reason they're able to get away with playing Cantor. They don't really have that dynamic pick and roll threat who's really going to blow past Cantor and finish at the rim the way some other teams might now.
Eventually, hopefully, Chandler Parsons could be that guy. But right now, Chandler Parsons is not that guy, especially when he's on a minutes limit. And that was one of the weirder elements of that second half, was he hadn't gotten quite to his minutes limit. So he played a couple minutes. I think it was like the first three or four of that third quarter, and then he was gone.
All right, Periscope question at Miller6270 Adams offensive game. Sorry, sometimes these don't have a space in between them. Adams offensive game. How do you see his growth? Should he be utilized more on offense?
We talked about this on we do a 15 and 60 on Dunked On, where we go in depth on every team in a conference. We did that on the West. Adams has gotten a lot better as a post-up player over the course of this year. He was getting good looks early, but wasn't converting them, is converting them now, and also has been a better job passing out of the post. I believe he's something like 73rd percentile in terms of passing out of the post and their success on that. So they should use him more, but offensively, he's not as good at generating quality offense as Russell Westbrook. So if they went to something more like a stagger, you could use his offensive gifts more. However, I like having Adams on the floor with Westbrook because he's their best defender.
Adams has increased his usage quite a bit so far this year. He was at 12.6% last year, now 16.3%. So that's a pretty big jump for someone like him. And I think really also his post-ups have gotten a lot better. Now, I think something, now that he's getting more looks down there, that teams are going to start realizing is that he's going left shoulder every single time, basically. And Gasol was all over that, but Adams is so strong, he was still able to like step through past Gasol and shoot a couple of shots. But yeah, I mean, whether he's on the right block, he's going to turn baseline, shoot the jump hook. If he's on the left block, he's going to try and go middle, shoot the jump hook. That's something that I think can work against smaller players, not great post defenders. Probably not going to work unless he gets a counter move going over his right shoulder. But that's something I think he can develop, and he's really developed a nice touch in that shorter range. He's shooting about 46% from the 3 to 10 foot range.
And he's also still pretty young. He played 1 year at Pitt, so he could grow in that way. And I think he can get a little bit better physically, just keeping on moving that direction. Interesting Periscope question from Miller6270. What's a realistic Rudy Gay to OKC trade?
I don't think there is one at this point. As long as the Kings are hanging around, it's probably not going to happen.
If the Kings had fallen off and the Thunder had, I was going to say Sixers because it's going to tie in. If they had not made the Ilyasova trade, while Ilyasova is not the greatest fit, he is a nice piece of salary filler that would have been useful in that trade because he would have helped Sacramento. At this point, it's hard to figure it out. And also because theoretically, if the Kings were to trade Rudy Gay, they would be looking for future assets because he's an upcoming free agent. And Oklahoma City isn't exactly asset rich because the assets they have are players they want to keep.
Yeah, and they're encumbered now. Their 2018 and 2020 first round picks, at least portions of those are traded to Utah and to Philly respectively. This is from JMP IORK, Jim Pjork. What could Russ do with Houston shooters on the perimeter? We talked about this a little bit last time when we were discussing MVP. Quite a bit, I would say.
It would help his penetration so much because just the way the space that the Thunder players do not occupy on the floor is so noticeable because it brings everybody into the lane. He could do well with that. However, he is not the pick and roll maestro that James Harden is. So there is an element of it that he just wouldn't.
Although
be
we've
able to
never
do well.
Seen him playing in a solid four out system.
True.
Where, you know, I think he might be able to get there. I mean, he averages this number of assists for a reason. I agree, he's not quite to the level of Harden in terms of his craft, but and maybe nobody is at this point in the league. Harden's leading the league in assists too, but I think it's a little premature to say that he couldn't be just as effective there. And then, I mean, what he does in transition is just unbelievable, and he wouldn't have to do this, like, turn into the guy and post up in transition. He kind of does that because the bigs are already back. Those bigs are going to be standing in the corner trying to rush out to shoot shooters, and Russ just go right
to
the rim.
Well, I mean, even look at what Kevin Love did in this game, just running to the right corner. If he had a guy who could do that, that the other team had to scramble to defend against every possession, every transition possession, that would be a huge help.
All right, I think that's all I had really on this game. Did you have anything else, or should we move on? There are a few other questions about the Portland game, too. Maybe we should get back to those.
Yeah, let's do a little bit on that, and then we'll get to All-Star Starters, because I'm sure people are interested in that as well.
Absolutely. Okay. So this is from Best Johnny Rose. Crab has put up back-to-back over 20-point games. Can he keep it up? The answer is no.
He can't keep it up, but he can contribute it from time to time, and I really like him as a sixth man who can take advantage of the opportunities that are created, but he's not going to be this brutally efficient all the time.
Well, and he played the Lakers last game, and then he played a Cavs team that, you know, didn't really have it today, and some of the guys who are guarding him, as we established, not really do that great.
And he was 9 for 11 from the field. Like, he's not.
Yeah, I mean, but he's a guy who shoots over 40% on threes. I don't think he's going to develop a ton of game with the ball in his hands. He is what he is. I think he's someone who maybe on a team with a lot of other creators could play as a lower end starting two. On this team, I think he's very solid. You know, the question of whether it should be he or Turner playing, I think, though, in this game, what was notable too, I don't think they played a single second with two bigs. Leonard didn't play. Vonleh didn't play.
Yeah.
That's how they need to play. I think those guys are bad. And they certainly they're bad playing as two bigs.
Well, they're superfluous, and in this context, superfluous kind of means bad because they don't provide any value that Portland has. And unlike most teams out there, the Blazers actually have enough wings to make it work. That is one of the benefits of having Evan Turner, even if he's not what they want.
Dav 93 Richards, what is Evan Turner's real value from a contract standpoint? So
negative.
Well, okay, let me ask you this: coming into last year's free agency, what did you think he would get?
Maybe like $8 million. Year,
yeah, I mean, I could have been 4 for 40 wouldn't have surprised me.
What Harkless got
all right. So, like, look at like Solomon Hill got 4 for 48, right? Yeah. Like, it wouldn't have shocked me if he had gotten around that level.
Yeah.
But you know, obviously, it was pretty. And I think from what you hear, that was kind of about what some of the other offers were for Turner, frankly. A little winner's curse in action.
Well, and that gets into one of the other big problems with Turner and his value is that he's being paid like a starter, even if it's a fourth starter. And if other teams don't evaluate him that way, it gets even more difficult to find a landing spot for him because we're getting into a place now where there aren't that many teams that have cap space just laying around. So you're not making the comparison play of, oh, Evan Turner versus X free agent, because most of these teams don't have a lot of flexibility and he signed for another couple of years.
Well, and when we say real value, that would have been a reasonable value for him in last year's crazy use it or lose it free agent market. If we want to talk about going forward, the way he's played this year, you know, down at the bottom of the league in RPM, the way that he really chokes off your spacing with his lack of shooting, which we saw again tonight, a few wide open threes that he bricked, you know, then I think he's
that player on a more favorable contract.
Yeah, and traditionally, back in the old days before this cap spike, the mid-level exception went to guys who were, you know, either lower-end starters or pretty good backups. And maybe on the right team, like Boston last year, he could rise into that pretty good backup range. But I think on most teams, he's so difficult to fit around that you'd have to say $5 million a year, $7 million a year, 3 years, not four, when you consider that he's 27 right now, or was when he signed the contract.
A question from Miller's 6270. This Portland team straight up overachieved last season, right?
Nah, I don't think so.
Not really. I mean, they played to their talent level. They were misevaluated by many, including us. I mean, I think we were higher on them than most, but I didn't see this coming. But their offense was reasonably successful. Their defense was, I think, like 22nd or something like that, which is fine. The benefit that they had, though, was in terms of seeding, they might have been a little bit overachieving because some of the other
winning
teams
the playoff, the playoff series was overachieving. If you just say they are well below the quality of probably your average Western Conference.
And they were going to lose that series until Blake and Chris got hurt. So.
Right. Yeah. And that's, I mean, I think they found something with that starting unit with Harkless and Amini. Remember that those guys weren't together in the starting lineup most of last year.
Right.
So, and I think, again, when those guys play together, those five are pretty good. You fill in a little bit of bench guys around them that makes sense. You don't ever play two bigs. And now you're starting to really do a little something here. All right. Yeah. Miller 6270. I think we've done like three of your questions now. So
hey.
You have hoodwinked our producer, but you cannot hoodwink us anymore. We are not answering any more of your questions. Good questions, though they were, however. Let's get to
this
one.
If they're good, I'll keep answering.
Grant Farmer 10, what could the Blazers theoretically get in return for trading CJ? And I mean, I'll start this off by saying, I think this idea that he needs to be traded, that those two guys can't play together, I find that rather specious reasoning. But if they did try to trade him, what's out there?
You would definitely want to, a rim protecting five at this point. I mean, because you're not going to get that real star two-way, small forward or something like that. You're not going to get the answer to everything in one player there. And there aren't that many true fives that are in that kind of trading range, because the guys that are really good, like let's say Rudy Gobert, I don't think the Jazz are going to trade. And the players that are a little bit worse than that, some people have brought up Nerlens. Nerlens also has a different financial situation because he's about to get paid, but they're not good enough.
Yeah, the teams that you want to trade with to get something good back, I mean, you're basically trading for guys that are probably worse overall players than CJ, because that's how the NBA works. You don't trade a guy who's just as good at one position for a guy who's just as good another position. There are not those types of trades to be made, because I mean, let's say that you thought that Chicago, for example, and I think Jimmy Butler is way better than CJ, but you would never be able to trade CJ for Chicago. You would never be able to trade him to a team that has a guy as good as him, because that team's already good. They're unless the guy's about to be a free agent, but then you've got CJ under contract for 4 more years. Why would you want to do that deal? So what the type of trade you're doing is, we think that we can trade him and get worse quality guys who fit in better, but this is a team that already supposedly has some depth. I don't think that a center, there's no great center on any of these teams that might want him, and he's under contract for so long too. That's why he's such a good asset for that reason.
Also, he fits in with their timeline. If they were going to get somebody else, maybe you get somebody who's raw, somebody who's younger, but then that player might not age out right with Dame Lillard
is, and CJ for that matter, are a little older. Those guys are 25, 26 right now.
So if you trade him for a 22-year-old, then that player is probably not going to peak until Lillard's getting a little bit out of it. And if you trade for somebody who's older than CJ, then you're narrowing your own window. So I don't see it as a cogent thing. And more importantly, to the crux of the real issue, I think you can build a successful team. Maybe not a championship team unless you got a really great center, but you can build a conference finals team with Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum as two of your best players.
I mean, in the last 15 years, you'd be hard pressed to find trades between two decent teams of good players for good players. That's the trades that happen, are good players for future assets. That's what happens. You realize, hey, this guy doesn't fit our timeline. We're not going to be good for a while. We're going to rebuild. He might be coming to the end of his contract. We're going to trade him. A guy like CJ, a 20-point a game scorer who's actually efficient, we're not talking about Monte Ellis here, he's a good character guy, who's under contract for the next 4 years, not the kind of guy who really gets traded very often, unless it's for just an absolute superstar. And, maybe the analog for him is Eric Gordon on the Clippers.
Mm-hmm.
That's maybe, and remember, Gordon was a different player before the injuries. That's kind of where you could look at him as in the hierarchy, but he's probably even more established than Gordon was at that time.
You also always want to have the caveat of, somebody could make a ridiculous offer. I think back to Serge Ibaka, where, Oklahoma City probably was willing to move him anyway, but the offer they got from Orlando was completely ridiculous. It's hard to project that sort of
offer. I don't know if it was ridiculous at that time when they were thinking of bringing back KD. I think I actually probably
saying it was ridiculous for Orlando to offer that much. It's just, if somebody misevaluates your asset in a way that is positive for you, then you consider that sort of trade. And those sorts of things can happen, but you can't really project it as a realistic trade target, because that's the whole point.
And the reason I like CJ and Dane together is, and this is not the way Portland saw it, I don't think, by getting Turner, but those two guys together make a great offense by themselves. And now you can have more defense around them than maybe you would normally be able to have with kind of a more normal team.
One of the perks of being a longtime media member is that sometimes you can actually get a ticket when there are some extras for your family. Unfortunately, I'm not a longtime media member, at least not yet. I've got quite a few years to go before I would ever ask for that type of favor from a PR staff. So I use SeatGeek just like everyone else when I want to go to a sporting event, take my girlfriend who's become a big Warriors fan since we're living out in the Bay Area. We're going to go to the Warriors-Kings game up in Sacramento at the beginning of February. And the first place to look for tickets, of course, is SeatGeek. Buying tickets used to be an enormous hassle, no longer with SeatGeek. It saves you time and it saves you money because you can rest assured that you're getting a good price with SeatGeek because they aggregate ticket sites together instead of you having to go to 8 or 9 sites. Zach Lowe and his ad actually said 10 or 11, so he's one up me because I would only go to 8 or 9 sites. I guess he was even more dedicated looking for tickets than I was. But nonetheless, SeatGeek is also fantastic because each SeatGeek ticket is given a grade based on value. So you can see any underpriced seats, fairly priced seats, look in the general area that you want to sit, see that grade based on value, and you can rest assured that you're getting the best value because their advice algorithms are pretty good. Danny used to be in the ticket business. He says that they basically line up with what his judgment would have been. So it saves you time because you only have to go to their app, and saves you time again because you don't have to look through every seat and figure out which one is going to be the best value. SeatGeek takes care of that all for you. So you can download that free SeatGeek app, go into the settings tab, click add a promo code. And the third reason you want to try them is you can get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase via rebate after you've made it. Enter the promo code CAPSPACE, the familiar promo code that we talk about all the time here on the program, and SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first purchase. So download the free SeatGeek app, enter promo code CAPSPACE today.
All right, that's enough on that. Let's do some all-star starters here. Are we ready?
So the foundational piece here is that we're abiding by the rules that the NBA sets, because that's really the only fair way to do this. And the NBA rule for starters is 2 backcourt players and 3 frontcourt players. However, since they don't require a big man, however that was going to be defined, we're not going to have to do that.
Yeah, we'll talk actually after we do this about like how we would change the voting. We actually had some pretty interesting proposals, so stay tuned for that. We'd love to hear what your thoughts are on that. But let's start off here in the Western Conference. I think we're both going to be in agreement on the guards that it's James Harden and Russell Westbrook.
We both have them 1 and 2 in the MVP, so I don't think you can realistically pick other people as your all-star starters if you have them 1 and 2 in the MVP.
Well, is there any argument at all for Steph Curry and Chris Paul, who would be the other two?
It's fan voting, so I mean, you could say deserved and got nothing to do with it. I mean, you can go back to
deserve ain't got nothing to do with that. I think is the quote.
Sorry, Snoop. But or Unforgiven, either way. But yeah, I think that you can make an argument from fan voting perspective. Those guys are both incredible to watch. They've had better careers. But if we're judging it on this year and what they've done, which is the way that I think of an all-star starter, you have to go with Westbrook.
Well, and Curry is having a down year. If Paul had played at the same level that he was, the Clippers played at the same level they did early in the year,
and
he
didn't miss time.
Yeah, then it might be more of a question. So in the front court, I think we're probably also going to be in a clear agreement here on Kawhi Leonard and Kevin Durant as 2 of the 3 forward.
And they bridge this gap of being incredibly good players that are having excellent seasons, both of which might be under the radar a little bit just because they're not at the same MVP case as Russ and Harden, but both are absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, and you look at who, we'll get to the other front court people, I think there is a very clear drop off. The contenders that I had, Draymond Green, Anthony Davis, DeMarcus Cousins, Rudy Gobert were the other ones that I had. Is anyone that you also put in consideration?
I had Marcus on consideration, but he didn't get it.
Oh, yeah. I that was a brain fart. He clearly should have been in there, too.
Yeah. I had Gasol first team All-NBA when we did our awards podcast about a week ago, and I still think Gasol was in consideration. However, I didn't end up picking him for this, partially because of the All-Star format, and also partially because Anthony Davis is having an absolutely fabulous season. And
So why did you pick Gasol for your first team All-NBA center, and now you're picking AD to start over?
Because we have more of a sample now. And also, I was looking back, and so since the Pelicans switched it and basically pulled their traditional centers out of the lineup, the Pelicans have been the number 2 defensive team in the league.
His defensive numbers have been very good. In fact, one of the reasons that Davis, who was my pick as well, I'm surprised we were in agreement given where you were last week, but I'm never going to complain if someone comes around in my way of thinking.
Enjoy it while it lasts.
But I mean, AD only rates poorly in RPM because his offensive RPM isn't that good. And on this Pelicans team that has few other threats, like, I feel very confident that AD is a very, very good offensive player.
And he's what, second or third in PER right now?
So. Yeah. So I think when you see how well they've defended him being in a good system, part of that's him, part of it's the guys around him. But I think it's been pretty solid.
So do we both have AD there? But how would you kind of order it? Because it's tough for me. The next two were Draymond and Marc Gasol. I didn't really have an order. Draymond's having an absolutely great year. And again, the All-NBA thing doesn't matter here because Draymond doesn't count as a center for me. He counts as a forward.
Yeah, and I probably would have gone with Draymond Green as well. I think, you know, he and Rudy Gobert are right up there, 1-2 to me in defensive player of the year. The Warriors defense has not missed a beat at all after the first week or two of the season. And I think Green provides a little more offensive value than Gobert does. Gasol has got to be up there due to like the clutch performance that he's had as well. I think, and then Cousins, you know, I think at one point you could make an argument that he was a decent defensive player. I think those days are past. I think he's not in as good a shape as he had been. He's been the best offensive center in the game. I think maybe you could say that AD is, but now that he's a center, but it's still, again, until the Kings actually win some games with him, I'm kind of out on him.
And if you want a sense of how ridiculous the eventual All-Star stuff is going to be in the Western Conference, at least one of the players that we just discussed in the front court will make the team, because there are so many guards that are going to have to make the team that they're going to have to thin it out. And that's part of the reason why the All-Star game should have more roster spots.
Let's see if we have any comments here. All right, no, not yet. Let's do the East, and then this comment relates to the East.
Okay, so in the East, the basic, so we'll start with the guards again just to make it easier. Kyle Lowry, I think, is unambiguously on this team. If you wanted, there are arguments for other guys, but Lowry has been the linchpin of one of the league's best offenses. And, you know, they haven't been great defensively, but he hasn't been the reason for that pretty comparatively. So I think
he's the best defensive player on their team, I think. At least he plays
and at least in their starting five, yeah.
Yeah.
And so you have Lowry. That second spot, though, gets thorny.
Well, I think for a lot of people, they would be surprised that it's so clear that it's Lowry. I think we should explain that a little more. I'm in agreement with you. Number four in the league in RPM, 45% shooting on three-pointers, which is obviously fantastic. We said that he's one of the better defensive players in the league. He plays a ton of minutes. His team has one of the best offenses of all time, and he is probably the biggest impetus for that. Well,
and he's also the only starter in that Lowry plus bench unit, which has been one of the best lineups in the entire league. I mean, I believe they've fallen off a little bit since that insane early start to the year, but they've still been phenomenal, and he's the piece of continuity. I don't think there's much of an argument as an all-star to put DeRozan over him, his own teammate, but there are arguments for a couple other guards that are the centerpieces of their own offenses that are not as good as Toronto, but still really good. And for me, the next two spots, I mean, you only get one of them, but it's between Isaiah Thomas and the apparently aggrieved John Wall. We didn't cover that game, but I'm going to be interested in tracking it.
Yeah, I think for most casual fans, you'd have to include Kyrie Irving and Kemba Walker in this analysis. Kemba, one of the issues for me is he hasn't quite been at this level so far yet. I think that Kyrie, as a playoff player, absolutely, and he gets a little extra credit for me for what he did in the playoffs, especially in the finals last year. Did have, he's averaging 24 a game on pretty efficient play, but they also are worse when he's on the court. His defense is problematic. I went with Isaiah. Ultimately, John Wall probably would have been my second, but Isaiah is over 60% true shooting, crazy usage, averaging like 27, 28 a game. Also has been unbelievable in the clutch too. Again, he had 20 in the fourth tonight, as well as they had a nice comeback win against the Wall's Washington Wizards. So I think just what he's been able to do offensively, not even playing that many minutes a game either, and to still be scoring 28 a game, I get his defense is supposed to be an issue, but if you're scoring that well, it's pretty hard for me to have that big a problem with your defense. And he's, I mean, they have nobody else on offense who can really create a shot, and they're one of the best offenses in the league.
They're seventh in offense, and it was even more jarring early in the season when he was really their only offensive player. He was their alpha and their omega when Al Horford was out. They were still in the top 10 in offense. Now they're seventh. So they're also better in terms of offense than the Wizards and the Hornets. So if you're going to go with Kemba, those players all shoulder a pretty similar offensive load. He has the best team there, and the supporting cast, I would say Wall has a better offensive supporting cast than Isaiah does. And Kemba, it gets close. They've also been dealing a lot with injuries. So, but I think Isaiah's done the best job of any of those, and he's been really
are pretty good. Subjectively to me, with the eye test, he's fallen off a little bit. Those numbers can be wonky even over a season or multiple seasons, not to mention, you know, what we've had now, less than half of a season. So I'm trusting my eyes a little bit more than I'm trusting the numbers on that. And that's part of why I'm giving him a little bit of a knockdown.
And again, at least one of those guys isn't going to, if we're including Kemba and Kyrie, at least one of those guys isn't going to make the All-Star team either.
Let's move on to the front court.
Again, like the West front court, two players that I don't see a cogent argument against them, LeBron James and Giannis. Both of them have been spectacular this season, integral parts of successful teams, and just a head and shoulders above, maybe not head and shoulders above, but significantly above everyone else.
Yeah, I think that's right. And then Giannis, the on-off stuff is great. PER, he's like in the top five in the league. The Bucks team performance, really not having another person that you would think of as an established star. He's been outstanding this year. Has hit a couple of big clutch shots too, including that one to beat the Knicks. So no real argument to me against those first two. Gets more interesting when we get to that last front court spot.
Last front court spot, there are a lot of players that you could make a credible argument for. Paul George, Jimmy Butler, Kevin Love, Paul Millsap. I think that's probably the main group. Can you think of anybody else that's...
No, I don't think so. And to me, it really became down to Butler versus Love. George has fallen off a little bit this year, perhaps in part just due to what's been around him as well. Their defense hasn't been as good. They've kind of just been around 500. It's been somewhat of an underwhelming season for the Pacers. They've kind of fallen off the radar a little bit. And you wouldn't be like making a crazy argument to me that Paul George is still better than Jimmy Butler in like a playoff setting. But I think Butler clearly has been better so far throughout the course of the year. And just given what he's had to create, Love benefits immensely from the presence of Irving and James. I mean, those three-pointers that he's hitting, that's important. He spaces the floor. He helps them much as in the same way that they help him. But in terms of when I think of creating efficient offense is one of the things. And then Love still has some weaknesses defensively, even if those may be overstated at times. Butler is an excellent defensive player.
And Butler isn't always pushing it defensively the way that he used to because he shoulders so much of the offensive burden. But even a little semi-distant defensive Jimmy Butler, when he's that way, still a whole heck of a lot better than Kevin Love. I draw the distinction between dependent and independent talent. So like Kevin Love is one of the best dependent talents in the league. I think offensively it's him and Klay Thompson and a couple other guys, but Jimmy Butler could be decent at that too, and Jimmy Butler can do something that Kevin Love cannot. So I went with Jimmy Butler. And again, like you, Love was considered. I consider Paul George, and Paul Millsap's having a wonderful year too. John Schumann tweeted out today that the best defensive duo in the league right now is Millsap and Dwight Howard, which is
not a surprise. That's a great defensive front court.
It's a great defensive front court. And I mean, Dwight's having a wonderful year as well, just kind of below consideration here. So Millsap hasn't really done much to dissuade me from this group, but Jimmy Butler, like Giannis, has really upped his game this year.
And you consider how little spacing the Bulls have had for parts of this year, playing with Rondo. I mean, look at who else is in that starting lineup. Like, he's had to just, you know, go against like stacked defenders time after time.
I mean, we talked about how Paul George has had a rough go of it to a degree this year. Jimmy Butler has a similar circumstance, but the Bulls have risen above it more.
Yeah. All right. Quick question here from Garrett Catalana. Do you think Joel Embiid is a legitimate all-star candidate? I think so. I have not looked at the reserves quite as closely to see who the competition is. Certainly someone I'll be considering, but hasn't played enough minutes or games to probably really get in there for me.
Definitely not a starter like that. He hasn't been worthy of that. I mean, if it's fan vote, there's nothing you can really do about it, but he definitely gets consideration. I mean, we talked about, I think was sometime last week, about that the two best centers, in my opinion, in the East, and I think in yours too, are Al Horford and Dwight Howard. So I would put him behind those players at this point, but he's not far enough behind them where you say, oh, he's out of contention.
Yeah. And let's see here. Let's get to some Twitter questions here and then see where we're at after we get through those. This is submitted prior to the show with the hashtag #TwitterNBAShow. You can always submit those on the day of the show, even earlier in the day if you want to, and we try to get to all of them here. Let's start with Zanny Glover. The Sixers are 4-1 since Okafor is removed from the rotation. Is he a lost cause?
No, he's not as good as Joel Embiid and Nerlens Noel. Big whoop. There are a lot of teams that have front court players that aren't better than those guys. The Sixers have some of the weirdest positional log jams in NBA history. That said, I'm less certain that Okafor can be a reliable starter at this level long term, and that really hurts his value in that sense. So I wouldn't consider that being a lost cause. Him being a very talented backup, maybe in the mold of Enes Kanter, is certainly a possibility. I don't consider that a lost cause.
A couple of reasons I would agree with you. Number one is he really had those knee surgery that he lost the last 6 weeks of last year. Then he missed basically all of training camp as well. So hasn't really been able to get into the groove himself this year. He's shown very slight improvement defensively. The 7'5 wingspan, if he didn't have that, he's got a nice standing reach. He's still like very deft moving his feet. On offense, sense. The awareness is definitely a problem, you know, but when he's 25, 26, because he has these long arms, he's shown a little bit when he gets into position. He can kind of do those like Tim Duncan, not leaving your feet blocks every once in a while. So I think there's still hope for him. I think he can be a dominant offensive force. He has not had a chance to play with the floor space around him. When he does play, it's with some of these Sixers backups. Again, you know, even their designated shooters like Covington aren't hitting. Like if he could play with Ilyasova or something, then it might be a little different. If he could play with a great pick and roll point guard, I think he could be an excellent pick and roll finisher. Is he going to justify being drafted number three in what was a very good draft? Is he going to justify being picked over Kristaps Porzingis? Probably not. But no, I'm not ready to give up on him. But it may get to the point where we just Philly has no choice but to sell low on him. That's not the end of the world, though. That was the whole point of drafting all these centers, was let's hope that one of them turns into a star. And yeah, you know, you may have to trade him for less than the assets that you put into him, but you did get a star out of that process.
Well done. Also, the third pick in the draft, I mean, it depends a lot on the draft itself, but the quality of what you get from that pick, if you get a high-end rotation player, it's not what you wanted, but it's not the worst thing in the world. I mean, we're looking at later in that same lottery, Mario Hezonja is not getting any sort of rotation love at all. Willie Cauley-Stein gets DNPs all the time, and those guys were drafted
Emmanuel Mudiay is struggling too. I mean, yeah. Other than Porzingis, you really would have to get down into like the Devin Booker range to find someone that's clearly been, you know, better than Okafor.
And like the year before, Dante Exum, you know, I loved Exum as a prospect. I had him number one on that draft board over Joel Embiid. He hasn't proven that much more than Jahlil Okafor has, and he has been in the league a year longer, but he missed 1 year due to injury.
Yeah, I think he's probably proven less. I mean, Jahlil Okafor averaged 17 and 11 on decent efficiency last year as a rookie. We know he has defensive problems, but a lot of guys are never going to average 17 points.
Here's one Periscope question from Ariel Praz. Where is Karl Anthony Towns on your rankings on the West front court?
Low, not really in consideration, just because the Wolves haven't been good enough. And I think he hasn't done a good enough job defensively.
He suffers a lot because he is a wonderful offensive talent, but there are two actualized offensive talents with questionable defense ahead of him in Anthony Davis and DeMarcus Cousins. Like, the argument for having Towns over Cousins is, to me, basically non-existent when you consider the defensive lack of a gap. And maybe Towns is more talented than that, but maybe not. And so I wouldn't have him above those guys. And the West is just so stacked that I hoped that this was going to be the year for him. He certainly has the ability to get back there, to get there very, very soon. But I don't think it's this year.
All right. Another one here. This is a Twitter question. Andrew Gerz 7. In your opinion, has Brogdon had the best season of any rookie from the 2016 draft class? That, of course, would exclude Embiid, drafted in 2014, and Saric, also drafted in 2014.
Yes, absolutely. He has produced on a team that needs him, and he has done a great job filling that role. Not many rookies can do that, and yes, he is older than Bradley Beal, but he's still doing it, and I've been really impressed.
Yeah, he's 24 already, but yeah, I mean, any rookie drafted in the second round, I mean, I think he might end up just holding on to that starting spot for the foreseeable future. Over Dellavedova until even though they brought in Dellavedova in free agency on a big contract.
Cordelli is going to learn old baseball history and find out about Wally Pipp.
Yeah, maybe we shouldn't invoke Lou Gehrig's name with Malcolm Brogdon.
Hey, Lou Gehrig had a wonderful career.
Yeah, I know. That's why we shouldn't be comparing Malcolm Brogdon to him.
I know.
Lou Gehrig's one of the best players ever.
I'll do this one quickly. It's a Periscope question. I cannot pronounce the name. I will just read it. XCSVCICO. How many Warriors will make it? There are three, with Draymond being the third, that feel like definites that they have to. Klay Thompson is the second best two guard in the Western Conference, maybe the second best two guard in the NBA, but considering how many point guards are in front of him, I don't think it's a lock that he makes it.
Yeah, he's in the mix with like Dame Lillard. I forget exactly what the rules are for the breakdown, and this is something we should probably save for next week, because we'll talk about our reserves, I think, next week on the show. So let's we'll probably limit it to the starters here. Let's get to this question. Benny Gann 53, submitted via Twitter. Thoughts on a Nerlens for Crabbe and the Cavs first trade?
Crabbe is the
Cavs first that Portland just acquired in the Varejao salary dump. That is this year, 2017.
Unprotected.
Unprotected.
Alan Crabb is a good player and in the short term would make the Sixers better. However, he is very expensive and is basically doesn't provide a lot of that surplus value at this point. You know, even if he is what they would hope for, he's paid properly. And they have a wealth of cap space. So there, I don't think that's a great
They can do better in the free agent market this year with the, with that contract. I think the free agent market is going to be more favorable to teams this year.
And they're one of the only teams that has a ton of money. There aren't a ton of great players on it, but I would say that Crabb's contract is either...
And Crabb is a trade bonus too.
Oh, you're right. You're right.
So although I believe now you're under the new CBA, you would be able to waive that even if it wasn't required to make the salaries fit. But I think this wouldn't happen during the new CBA, so it'd still be the old rules. So yeah, he's going up to even more than $18 million a year if he gets traded. Probably has a 15% trade bonus because the restricted offer sheet that he signed with the Nets was made as unpalatable as possible.
And that gets into the reason of why a Nerlens to the Blazers trade is really challenging, because the Blazers don't have a ton in that area. Like, they have cap filler. Somebody like Festus Ezeli could work there. But then if you're going to use cap filler, then you have to have other assets, and they have two first-round picks.
I feel like that would probably get it done at this point. Like, a Blazers own pick this year and that Cavs pick, that might be enough. That might be enough to get it done. But I think Philly is still trying to build up his value a little bit. He's been playing now. They've been playing much better, 4-1, as the previous questioner mentioned. So it's maybe Nerlens will be increasing his value because he's playing more now. But that seems in the type of range that we're talking about. Because if there are better offers than that out there, he probably would have been traded already.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because he's going to be a free agent at the end of this year. We always got to remind people.
We'll have to couch this one a little bit, but I still, since it was asked, I feel like answering it. K_Venz19. Who do you think is going to be a star from next year's draft? I admit that I have not watched a ton of the college guys. We did see the Nike Hoop Summit. The only player that I've seen that looks like a star to me is Markel Fultz of Washington. He's a phenomenal talent, athletic, good court vision, unselfish. And I wouldn't say that I expect him to be a star, but he certainly has that ceiling.
I haven't watched enough to say it.
There we go.
What else we got here?
Got a couple more fake trades.
Oh yeah, here we go.
So from Dorian Gibson 84, do you think the Blazers could trade CJ, Crabb, and picks for Jimmy Butler?
Well, you'd have to add a lot. Part of the reason that CJ, by the way, we should mention this, he counts right now at what his salary is currently, which is like, you know, probably like $4 million or something like that. So the Blazers can only get back $4 million, but any team that receives him, because he signed that extension already, he's going to count for over $20 million. So that makes it very difficult to trade him before the offseason. And I also think that they would want to see where they're going. I think the Bulls would want to see where they're going before that. Crabb, I think, has a little bit of negative value to take on. There's a Bulls team that thinks they're going to use cap space maybe this summer as well. Maybe get Dwayne Wade to recruit. Maybe now that Rondo has been out of the rotation, they can play a little bit better when half their team isn't ill. So I don't think that that's necessarily realistic. That's so much more outgoing salary than salary coming back. Both of those guys actually, I think, are going to make more than Butler next year. So you would have to come up with some more salary to go back from the Bulls. And the Bulls actually, other than Dwayne Wade, they don't have a ton of extraneous salary that goes on the books other than maybe Robin Lopez. And the Blazers already decided that they didn't really want to get in the mix to re-sign him at his contract.
Yeah. Another CJ, fake CJ trade, just for the fun of it, since you asked for fake trades. From @Billy_Hickman, McCollum for Derek Favors and Alec Burks. Does that make sense?
Oh, let's see. McCollum for Favors and Burks. Well, again, it would have to happen after this season. That could actually be a little more realistic if Burks could get healthy, if we see if Favors can make it through a year healthy. If Favors does not extend with the Jazz, they have that cap space they could use, either extend Hill or Favors. Hill is a free agent this offseason. We'll see whether Hill would be a nice fit with CJ in the backcourt, because Hill can guard either guard position. And CJ could play some point guard too. They still have Hood. Burks is a little superfluous. That's not crazy. That's probably the best one that I've heard so far.
Would you be comfortable with Favors starting at center next to Aminu and Harkless?
I like him because he is mobile. He could switch a little bit. He has failed at times as really your primary rim protector, but many of those minutes have also been played next to Enes Kanter, which didn't help matters. So we'll see. We'll have to see too how he does in that role as the backup center next to some players, combo forward types, flawed defensive fours that are somewhat similar maybe to what he'd play next to in Portland. So yeah, that would be interesting to see. I mean, because you really look for the defensive upgrade. And but if Utah feels like, hey, we can't re-sign this guy, the issue there too, though, is, I mean, CJ is under contract for way longer than Favors.
It's like a weird form of a challenge trade, just in the sense that both they know what the players are, but you think maybe you could do better just with a different allocation of talent. And they would, I think they would have to have some sort of understanding with Derek Favors. They would have full bird rights on him, but they wouldn't be able to extend him at any point for now.
All right, I think it's time to end the show here, because this guy, Giancarlo Finotti, fake trade, Whiteside for Klay Thompson. I think we're done here.
I think we're done here. It'd be fun, though. I would enjoy seeing Klay Thompson defending in Spo's system, just with all those other kind of like combo-y guards. That'd be kind of fun, but no.
Yeah, and he could play the four in Miami.
Anyone can play the four in Miami.
Yeah. All right. And also that's the airplane ding as well. Our audio system here shutting down. All right. So that's enough here. All we need really are like the police sirens to really like lock it down for us. Follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. To be alerted of these things, click on the little bell next to my name on the Twitter mobile app, and that'll allow you to get live notifications. There's an option to do that. And also listen to my podcast, Dunked On, where we run this as a later cast at times if you can't catch the show live, or we do a lot of other awesome shows as well.
Yeah, and we do a mix of kind of in-depth analysis of different teams and different games with, you know, other topics, like we do awards podcasts and everything else like that. So you can check that out. It's out about 5 times a week, and you know, it's fun to do that, and it's also fun to do this.
All right, thanks everyone for listening. We will talk to y'all next time.